So we've talked. This is our third conversation. What's on your mind today, Nolan?
Well, I was kind of going to continue off what we discussed in the previous video.
Okay.
At the beginning of the last video, we talked about the Gulag Archipelago.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent you an email earlier today with some of the excerpts that I thought were interesting.
Let me pull that up. I haven't looked at email today. Okay. Let me see how small I can make my screen so I can see the email. Okay, go for it. Quote I mentioned in the previous video, if only it were so simple, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and if it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? Yeah, that's a great quote.
Yeah, I like the last line as well.
Yeah. Well, and that's true. I actually often, so people have strategies for making the world better. That's a pretty normal thing. And one of the strategies is exactly as Solzhenitsyn describes. You've got the good people and the bad people. And so, well, you just, if you get rid of the bad people, okay, well, how are you going to get rid of them? Well, you could exile them, marginalize them, silence them, exclude them, or kill them. Okay, and actually, I think one of the interesting test cases in the Bible on this is actually Noah's flood, because in Noah's flood, God saves the best man and his family out of all the world, and within a few generations, everything reverts back to normal, which in fact expresses Solzhenitsyn's observation here. So I think he's dead on right.
Yeah. And so the second one there is about Solzhenitsyn trying to find a way to remember his experience and not losing sight of what's important.
Okay. Shall I read it?
Sure.
Okay. Each year on the anniversary of my arrest, I organize myself a Zex day, a prisoner's day. In the morning, I cut off 650 grams of bread. It's not a lot. Put two lumps of sugar in a cup and pour hot water on them. For lunch, I ask them to make me some broth and ladle of thin mush. And how quickly I get back to my old form. By the end of the day, I am already picking up crumbs to put in my mouth and licking the bowl, the old sensations start up vividly. Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, page 461. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I completely believe that. I always kind of chuckle when people admonish others to live in the moment. I've told stories about the homeless man that lived outside my office door, and people would say that. I think he lives in the moment every day. It's a disaster. but Solzhenitsyn forcibly reliving that moment every year in the anniversary of his arrest is also a helpful thing.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I remembered most.
And how do you, I mean, why, how does that, how does, why does that quote impact you?
I think it's something useful for us to try and keep in mind when we're going through our day-to-day lives. So I find that, you know, sometimes it's difficult to be grateful about what we have. And reading that book and that part really helps remind me of what how many good things I do have. It's also helpful to remember that even people who had a direct experience of losing almost everything, even they still have struggles with that if they are out of that environment long enough.
I often, one of my early observations to the victim culture that I saw emerging was the sanctification of victims. And I immediately noted the interesting juxtaposition between that and another aphorism, which was that hurt people hurt people. In that it's often the victims of, let's say, child abuse, who some of the victims of child abuse, as Peterson reminds us, that grow up to become abusers themselves. Now, not all of the victims of child abuse do, but some of the victims of child abuse do. And so on one hand, we imagine that those who have been victimized are somehow safe because they certainly wouldn't perpetrate those kinds of evils on others. But at the same time, we recognize that it's often the pain that scar the pain and abuse that scars us, and those scars spur us on to, in fact, continuing the hurt by doing it to others. And so it's a funny juxtaposition in victim culture. And I think, again, Solzhenitsyn gets that because he saw that many of the cruelest guards had been victims of cruelty themselves. And so sometimes suffering makes us more compassionate, and sometimes suffering makes us more angry so that we just simply continue it. So it's a fascinating observation.
Yeah, I found when he discusses that's useful to try and understand, because he kind of says there's two different ways of responding to that suffering or victimization that you experience. One way is to decide that you never want to be someone who does the same thing. And the other way is to kind of get lost in your resentments about it and end up falling into the same thing that you yourself hated about what you experienced.
It is a very interesting dynamic. And, you know, part of what, let's say, in Dante's Inferno, what is so interesting is that many of those in Dante's hell continue to try to work out, or they simply go deeper into the torments that brought them there. The same is true of C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, where someone whose predominant sin is complaining, the penalty for complaining is endless complaining. And, you know, there's a mystery about redemption, where the complainer finally gets sick of their own complaint to the degree that they realize they have to turn from themselves. And these are fascinating, fascinating relationships.
Yeah, it's kind of like your own behavior becomes your own punishment. And that's one of the interesting things about Dante's Inferno, about kind of all the symbolic punishments that we're going through. It's, I think some people would look at that story and not see that it's not exactly a like straightforward story about this thing that happened. Mm-hmm. It's more so about understanding what it's like to live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
One of the punishments that I remember when I read it was kind of interesting. Was the hypocrites were forced to wear this heavy cloak that weighed on them, but on the outside it was all golden and shining, but on the inside it was dark and heavy. Yeah, I think there was something else to it, but I don't remember.
Yeah, I took a class on Dante in college, and I so many of the classes I took in college, if I had the chance to retake them, I'd get so much more out of them now. Life is full of funny ironies.
So I guess we could read the next excerpt.
Okay.
Kind of funny, actually.
The absurd degree of deception. They were building an apartment building. And if somebody's never read The Gulag, it's a fascinating book. It's just story after story after story, and it's mind-boggling to understand how he could, you know, write this thing in secret and remember it all. And I mean, Peterson talks about the ways that he got this book out there. It's really a phenomenal thing. So they were building an apartment building, and the free employees stole several bathtubs, but the tubs had been supplied to match the number of apartments. So how could they hand over the apartment building as completed? They could not confess to the construction superintendent, of course. He was triumphantly showing the official acceptance committee around the first stair landing. Yes, and he did not omit to take them into every bathroom too and show them each tub. And then he took the committee to the second floor landing and the third, not hurrying there either, and kept going into all the bathrooms. And meanwhile, the adroit, inexperienced Zex, the prisoners, under the leadership of an experienced foreman plumber, broke bathtubs out of the apartments on the first landing, hauled them upstairs on tiptoe to the fourth floor, and hurriedly installed and putted them in before the committee's arrival. And it was their lookout if they let the wool be pulled over there. And it was their lookout if they let the wool be pulled over their eyes. This ought to be shown in a film comedy, but they wouldn't allow it. There is nothing funny in our lives except funny takes place in the West. That's a great story. And it would be, I mean, in Western terms, you could imagine, you know, Lucy and Ethel doing something like this to try to, you know, stay out of the trouble of Ricky and Fred. So what did you appreciate about that quote, Nolan?
I think it's just funny that they went through all that to maintain this lie.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good kind of encapsulation of everything that went on in the Soviet Union. And other places.
Yeah. And why such a system can't last.
Yeah.
Oh, I have an uncle who was a cop. And I used to, as a kid, I used to love to listen to his stories because he was a good storyteller, and he would tell the best police stories, because cops get all the good stories because this kind of thing, you know, might not be happening with the government as much or things like that. But, you know, just stupid criminal stories where oh, I love it.
I think that's another positive if you're going to read this book, is even in spite of all the dark stuff that it talks about, somehow there still seems to be humor to it.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a testimony to the goodness of God, that, you know, sometimes people will comment to me about my humor with the mentally ill. I tend to have gallows humor, but part of that is just because if you live in places where there is a lot of suffering and a lot of darkness, you know, about all you have left is laughter. And so when you see it, you might as well enjoy it, because that's what you got. And I'm sure that was the same in the Soviet Union and in the Gulag. And I've often noted that some of the best comedians in culture, if you find a really funny person, you'll almost always find some suffering that this person has endured. I think it's necessary. That's been my experience.
Yeah. There's a documentary I watched about, I forget what it was called, but it was about how the Holocaust created this kind of culture among Jewish people of dark humor and always trying to find something funny in the darkest places.
There's a documentary on Netflix too right now, which has a similar theme. They look at, you know, they look at, for example, comedy shows in Iraq, and, you know, go into the Muslim world where it's in some ways the most repressive, and you'll find great comedy.
Yeah. So there's the next section is kind of funny as well.
Okay. Two ridiculous arrests. The charge against Grigory, it is Russian names, yeah. Grigory Yamanovich Generalov from Molensk province was that he used to drink heavily because he hated the Soviet government. He actually used to drink heavily because he and his wife got along so badly. He got 8 years. It could be that he maybe he got a, maybe he was happy to get away from his wife. Irina Tukinskaya, the fiancée of Sovrinsky's son, was arrested while leaving church. The intention was to arrest their whole family, and she was charged with having prayed in a church for the death of Stalin. Who could have heard that prayer? Terrorism, 25 years. Prayed in a church for the death of Stalin. I love it. Oh, we can't have that.
Yeah.
Oh, that is good. Oh. Two examples of the malevolence that characterized the camps. Here's another imaginative trick. On the eve of May 1, 1933, in the Khabarovsk GPU for 12 hours at night, Chirbotaryev was not interrogated, no, but was simply kept in a continual state of being led to interrogation. Hey, you, hands behind your back. Wow. They led him out of the cell, up the stairs quickly, and into the interrogator's office. The guard left. But the interrogator, without asking one single question, and sometimes without even allowing Chebotaryev to sit down, would pick up the telephone. Take away the prisoner from 107. And so they came to get him and took him back to his cell. No longer had he lain down on his board bunk than the lock rattled. Chebotaryev, to interrogation, hands behind your back. And they got, and when they got there, take the prisoner from 107. For that matter, the methods of bringing pressure to bear can begin a long time before the interrogator's office. Wow, yes. 12 hours they did this to the guy. You know, and this gets into Peterson's idea of, you know, we know how to torture each other because we know what torture is ourselves.
It's kind of similar to the carrying sad bags that Peterson mentions about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Where there's really no purpose to it except to make the other person suffer.
Right. And this gets back to what we started talking about in terms of hurt people. It's a strange type of pleasure that we derive from the pain of others. And we might imagine that, you know, you've got this idea of the mirror neurons. When we see pain, we often do things to either to act in compassion or to isolate us from the person who is in pain. But there's this other side of us that enjoys the suffering of others. And then we make up stories in our mind, usually that they're evil. Again, this gets back to Solzhenitsyn's first quote, that they're evil. And therefore, the pain of the other is justifiable, and our practice of giving them pain is justified.
I guess you kind of put these kind of blinders on to kind of hide you from your true motives. But really behind it, sometimes it's just to make someone else suffer.
Yeah, yeah. And we don't want to be seen that way, but we are that way. And so we even lie about our own nature to ourselves.
It's kind of like when Verveke talks about the technical use of bullshit.
Yeah.
And it's like you're not really lying to yourself, but you're about convincing yourself that you're not doing it for a bad reason. There's some other justification for it.
Yep. Yep. No, that's really good. I like Verveke's observation with respect to bullshit and how that works in us. And in a sense, there's something deeply redemptive and corrective about our, you know, anti-bullshit in that sense. So, no, that's true.
I guess we may as well go through that last excerpt.
That one's
a bit darker.
And from the other Solevsky inhabitants, He learns things more awful than his eyes perceive. People pronounce the fatal word Sekirka to him. This means Sekimaya Hill. Punishment cells were set up in the two cathedrals there. Oh my. And here is how they kept prisoners in the punishment cells. Poles the thickness of an arm were set from wall to wall, and prisoners were ordered to sit on these poles all day. At night, they lay on the floor, one on top of another, because it was overcrowded. The height of the poles was set just so that one's feet could not reach the ground, and it was not so easy to keep balance. In fact, the prisoner spent the entire day just trying to maintain his perch. If he fell, the jailers jumped in and beat him, or else they took him outside to a flight of stairs consisting of 365 steep steps from the cathedral to the lake, just as the monks had built it. In illustration 4, the view up Sekimaya Hill as it is today. They tied the person lengthwise to a balan, a beam, for the added weight and rolled him down it. And there wasn't even one landing. The steps were so steep that the log with the human being would just go all the way down without stopping. Wow. Wow. You know, it's difficult to fathom the creativity that went into this. And see this for me is part of why I can't be a materialist, because when I think about the people that endured this, and when I think about the fact that probably many of them, their endurance of this was the last of their life. I cannot imagine a universe without a God who will judge and will redeem, because otherwise this world for me is, I don't know. This again, stories like this, I can't not be a Christian and see them, which seems completely opposite the motivation of others when they say, I can't believe in God because there's so much suffering in the world. Well, I can't believe in no God because of all the suffering in the world.
Yeah, there's kind of two ways of looking at it again.
Yeah. Well, what about these two stories grabbed your interest, Nolan?
Well, I think the first one is similar to what I just mentioned about the Peterson thing with the sandbags and carrying them across. The second one was more like enough like one story that kind of all the rest of the stories like encapsulated all of them in some sense. So I included this excerpt in an essay that I was writing about the Gulag, and this scene like the one story that really kind of give you an idea of what the rest of everything else was like. And there's actually a picture of that hill that kind of makes it seem even worse, but it's more so to seeing everything in one story, and even you could say just evil in one story is kind of the real kind of thing in the story. Like that kind of gives you some idea as to what you're talking about when you say that word.
And the fact that they did it in a cathedral, and the fact that, of course, 365 steps obviously means is symbolic of the year, and the taking the steps up would likely be a religious act and a pilgrimage of sorts that the pilgrim would ascend to the place of God. And then to take that place and turn it into this. Yeah, I think God would have something to say with those who did such a thing.
Yeah, I never even noticed that until you said that. I didn't really think. I kind of saw that it was 365 stairs, but I never thought about that, what it meant before until now.
To me, again, it gets into the you know, always the question of the problem of evil and the existence of God, that evil is pointed to as a reason why there is no God. But I have this kind of ontological argument with respect to our hope for justice and the existence of God. It would seem if we have any belief or hope in justice, that this really begs for the existence of God, in the same way that C.S. Lewis's argument from desire begs for the existence of God. It doesn't prove that there's a God, but the fact that we internally seemingly nearly universally have a sense of justice and a desire for justice would imagine that we would have that there might be a justice giver who put this in us. And especially in the light of responding to the kind of intentional, willful cruelty that gets displayed in these stories.
Well, I was kind of thinking about the same thing earlier today. I thought about what Peterson kind of says about the universities and kind of how they're helping push along this meaning crisis. And he kind of says that they're not telling a good story. So I was thinking about this idea of an ultimate justice, and that seems to be an even better story.
Yeah.
Than even what Peterson kind of talked about, which I think is valuable first place, but I'm not sure if it's ultimately enough.
So how's the writing coming, Nolan?
Pretty good. I haven't written that much poetry lately, but I've been kind of working on my website. I'm glad to put some of that stuff out there.
Good.
Should be done probably by the end of the month. I'm not sure what else I'm going to put on there yet, besides a few poems.
Okay. Well, I'm sure folks who will watch this will be interested in looking at your poetry. Can you recite any of it? Do you have any of it in your head right now?
Not really that I could recite, but
okay.
Maybe talk about one that I wrote that kind of ties into what we're talking about. I wrote one that was kind of about the meaning crisis. And I kind of used the cathedral as the image to describe this. But it was more like an upside down cathedral, which is kind of interesting considering the staircase thing. We were just talking about it. So I kind of use that as an image to describe this loss of meaning. And kind of like in a collapse from this idea of heaven and earth to just earth. Because at the end of the poem, the cathedral falls down. And it turns the speaker into dust and the cathedral into earth. So we can use that to describe the collapse. This materialist way of looking at things.
That's an interesting image of an upside down cathedral. And when you say upside down, do you literally mean upside down that way on the x-axis?
Not exactly, but more in the symbolic sense.
Okay.
That one of the lines is about the choir. And it's like there isn't any choir, but there is this cacophony of church bells ringing rather than the harmonious thing. And then I talk about the incense. And instead of smelling good, it smells like something decaying. And so I just kind of took all these elements and just made them the opposite.
That's interesting. I'm looking forward to you putting your website out there, and when you do, you'll have to send me the link.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty labor intensive. Do you have to dictate all of this?
Yeah, I dictated, but it wasn't really that long of a poem.
Okay.
But it was more putting all these little details in. So that's one of the things that I find poetry works well for me. Because it's not a super long page. It's not pages and pages of stuff to work with. Just more smaller things, but the work is really doing the small details. I'm trying to pay attention to each of the different elements. That was one of the things that I found interesting about Dante's Inferno. That he has all these things that you wouldn't necessarily notice by reading. Like split into three sections. And then each stanza is three lines. So there's all this thing point, all these things pointing to the Trinity. And then it's like if you add all the cantos up, you get 100. The square root of 100 is 10, which is the square of the Trinity plus 1, which is like the unity of the three. And then, of course, there's all the punishments that are kind of showing how it is that the sins the people committed kind of created this punishment. So that was a useful thing for me to read and figure out.
I haven't read Dante for a long, long time. And again, as I said, I took a course on it in college, but I think information is wasted on the young. They need it, but I couldn't appreciate it probably like I could appreciate it now. So you like Dante, you like Solzhenitsyn. What else are you reading that you're enjoying?
Well, I read that biography of Paul recently.
Oh, N.T. Wright's.
Yeah, I thought that was helpful to kind of understand the implications of the resurrection.
Yeah.
And why that's so pivotal to everything.
Yeah. I actually just had a conversation that Zoom didn't work, and so I can't post it. But the conversation I had just before yours, we were talking about Peterson. Have you seen the video of Peterson at Liberty University yet?
Yeah, I watched that, and I saw your video about it.
Okay, the person I was talking to mentioned how, you know, in many ways, and I think she was exactly right on this, Peterson takes the resurrection more seriously than a lot of Christians, because Peterson, I think, recognizes, as the early church did, and other Christians have, obviously, throughout the centuries, Peterson recognizes that if the resurrection is true, it actually reframes all of our lives, and it should make us free of care, fearless, and it should radically transform how we view this life. But even for Christians that will say, "Well, I believe in the physical resurrection," we don't act like we do. We tend to mirror secularist assumptions about, we basically mirror secularist value systems. And if in fact, as one great saint said, that the sufferings of this world are as a inconvenient night in a bad hotel to the glory that awaits us, that would transform how we deal with what we deal with now. But it doesn't in many of us. And that's really something important to that, you know. So when Peterson at Liberty talks about grappling with the resurrection, I think he's thinking clearly.
Yeah, I thought it was also, when I got out of that book, was sometimes I think certain interpretations of Christianity can lead people to believe that this life isn't important. But I found useful understanding that's more in the sense of heaven and earth coming together, rather than what we're doing now is, or where was this earth isn't worth saving kind of thing. Yeah. But it's more so of the heaven and earth coming together, which is a bit different. A while ago, I read Friedrich Nietzsche's book, Antichrist, and he had a problem with that idea of, but I think it was partially a misinterpretation on his part. Didn't quite know what Paul was talking about with some of these things. Because he wasn't saying that that this world is evil, like evil and like damned to perdition, as Peterson says, I think. But it's more so the uniting of a few things rather than this kind of binary way of looking at it.
I think that's right. I'd love to see, you know, a lot of the focus of Peterson's, well, as he keeps reminding us, he speaks as a psychologist. At some point, the metaphysical, the obvious metaphysical agenda of the Bible has to be dealt with, which as you said, which is what I very much agree with, is the story of the reconciliation of heaven and earth. As you know, as Verveke notes, that's an axial age concern. But that is the story of the Bible. And it, obviously the divorce of heaven and earth comes in Genesis chapter 3, and the resolution of it comes in Revelation 21. But it's I think you're very much right in that the getting the understanding the value balance of this age and the age to come is vital. And the Bible continues to demand both. This world is important, and the life of the age to come is important. And they are deeply connected and continuous, but that poses problems for us. We just have problems with value hierarchies. We're not good at it. But it's true. That's true. It's a good observation.
And then that kind of gets into the other thing you've talked about recently, which is, what kind of role do we have with regards to the age to come? How much of our agency or non-agency, how does that all balance out? That's one of the harder questions to try and figure out.
To say the least. Hard indeed. Christian, the best minds in Christianity have been struggling with it for 2,000 years.
Yeah.
Well, and it was interesting to me, and I'll do a video later this week, I hope, on the second video, the One More Question video that David Nasser does with Peterson, where they, you know, where they get down to wrestling with it. And Peterson says, well, you know, talks about how he's trying to think about it. And I thought, yeah, you and Augustine and Calvin and the Roman Catholic Church and Martin Luther, and, you know, how does God work, and Joseph from Genesis, you know, how does God work and our work, how do those things come together? We don't know.
Yeah, that kind of goes into the God number one thing and the God number two. And for me, I'm fairly comfortable with God number one, but God number two is something that's, I still don't quite have a grasp on. I'm comfortable with when everything is a theory, but then when the theory starts, what does the theory mean for you in your life? that's when things start getting a little more uncomfortable for me.
Yeah. Well, and the world that actually also maps onto the world as a forum for action, which is, of course, the great fork at the beginning of Peterson's maps of meaning. The world is a forum for action. Well, action demands decision of us, and decisions have consequences, and some of those consequences are quite enduring. So, yeah. Yeah. Tough. Well, we got a few more minutes. Any last things you wanted to get in, Nolan?
I'll have to think for a second here. I think I covered most of it, but I'll say one more thing here. Really appreciate that you're able to do this on your channel. I find it useful because you just kind of let people come on here and talk about whatever they want. And I'm not worried about them saying something that isn't quite right or isn't quite how you see things. That's one of the things kind of missing. Feel like you're able to express the questions you have or the doubts you have about things. I find it's more productive than trying to get everyone to see things the same way from the beginning.
Well, thank you. I find it a joy because, well, I don't see everything clearly. I'm not right about everything. And as you know, I think there's a lot of good rules in Peterson's 12 rules. And one of his rules, which I think is very true, listen to someone as if they have something to teach you. And if you actually do that rule, you will discover that pretty much everyone has something to teach you. And that's, I think, a part of the glory of God's common grace, that God scatters his wisdom and his glory throughout. And I think the hierarchies that develop, that limit the number of voices we hear to those that the crowd pushes up the hierarchy, actually impoverishes us. And so I'm delighted that I've been able to have the time and use my channel in this way. I think, oh, this is what YouTube is for, actually.
Yeah, I really like watching the other conversations as well. The one you posted recently about the violinist, that was pretty hard to ignore.
Well, the stories, you know, God is the best story writer of history, because history is the story he's writing. And as a pastor, you learn the stories out there are they're way more than even the bravest fiction writer would dare imagine. And so it's wonderful having the opportunity to sit and steward and listen to these stories. So, and you're part of that too, Nolan.
Yep.
So thanks for the conversation. And I like the quotes that you sent me, and I think that structured it. I think that structured it quite nicely. So, and you know, that's I just kind of give an open channel, and you know, it's great to see what comes. So,
yeah,
I appreciate it.
So, this time we covered most of the stuff I had written down. So
good. So do I have your permission to post this? Would you like me to post it?
You can post it.
Okay. All right. I will do that then. It'll probably be in a few days. I've got a few stacked up. So all right, Nolan, you take care.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.